the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, Ellen Coyne is a political correspondent at the Irish Times, but her new book, well, it's about a different type of politics. It's about the politics of an organisation. Well, it's called Dirty Dancing, the book, which, of course, is a play on a very famous movie from the United States of the 20th century. Ellen Coyne, tell us about your interest in Irish dancing and about the scandal which hit Irish dancing in recent years.
Well, to just confess, first of all, I had zero interest and, in fact, zero knowledge of Irish dancing before this kind of landed in my lap.
I'm sure. Did you not do it as a child?
Well, only in the compulsory way that all of us do, but the very rudimentary set dancing. I was nowhere near the glamour that you'd see in the INAC down in Clarny every February, like the gowns and the sparkle and probably most relevantly to me, the sporting prowess that's involved. I just didn't really have that. So I was never troubled by the world of Irish dancing until October 2022, I got this weird anonymous email. I still don't know who it was from or why it was sent to me, because I'd never written about Irish dancing before. And it had all this weird stuff in the subject line about how there was brown envelopes and backhanders and even an allegation of some sort of sex scandal in the world of Irish dancing. So obviously I knew nothing about Irish dancing, but I did know a little bit about what a scoop is. And I think that I could tell instantly that if even half of what this person was saying was true, it would be a very important and relevant story. But had I known in 2022 that I'd still be writing about it in 2025, I don't know if would I have been as eager to reply as quickly as I did to that email.
Okay. So tell us, first of all, how many children are involved in Ireland in organised Irish dancing? And then how much does it happen overseas as well?
Well, there's tens of thousands of children in Ireland. And probably if you expanded into the schools, the people who go on to professional dancing in Riverdance, Lord of the Dance, the people who go on from competitions to running their own schools, it's a massive industry. But as everyone knows, from the 1970s on in particular, it really boomed across the world. In the parts of the world like, you know, New York and Boston, where you'd have a lot of expats. But then post Riverdance, you had this trend where Irish dancing was popping up in parts of Asia where people had never been to Ireland before. They'd no claim to Ireland. This was like the first generation that was doing it. So globally, like you're talking about an industry, and I don't want to be offensive using that word, but if you think about the dresses, all these little economies that are kind of like satellites around the world of Irish dancing, it's worth billions, and it has, you know, it's priceless as well when you think about the value that it has as a cultural export, because it's not just a sport. It's kind of like a cultural art form, and it's a part of our heritage as well. And it carries a lot, an awful lot of soft power for Ireland too.
Okay. You mentioned there about the clothing and the hair. I mean, there's an awful lot of hair extensions and wigs and even for children, fake tan, isn't there?
Yes, and I think the one lesson that I learned from covering this story is that every single thing in Irish dancing is there for competitive reasons. So the reason that people wear double wigs, so they actually stack two wigs on top of each other, is because if you look taller on stage, if the wig is bouncier, it highlights the skill of the jumps that you're doing, so you'll get marked up at competitions. The reason the costumes looked like that is after Jean Butler went on stage with her stunning kind of svelte black velvet dress, the year after that, loads of girls rocked up in like similar kind of like Riverdance tribute costumes. All of them got marked down. So the following year, that was completely gone. And they reverted to type, to the, you know, these gowns that cost more than my wedding dress, really. Everything in Irish dancing, the only reason it exists and the only reason it has evolved is with the sole aim of getting marked up at a competition. Like really, on Cumasún na Roinne Gaeilge, it's the biggest and oldest governing body in the world. And it kind of has this prestige as being like the cultural custodian of Irish dance. But to be honest, when I was writing the book, I'm not really sure how true that claim is. I think CLRG and Irish dancing really revolves around competition more than it revolves around celebrating the culture or the history of Irish dancing at
okay,
all.
Okay, competition. And this, I suppose, where I find it difficult. I love a sport where you have a ball goes into a net or into a hoop or whatever, and you get a score for it. Or even if it's things like athletics or swimming, where you see the person who touches the ball first or breaks the tape to win a race. There's an enormous difficulty, isn't there, in actually judging. It's a bit like, I suppose, figure skating and other sports like that, gymnastics. But there's a big difficulty, isn't there, in actually deciding really who is better than others when they're all at a pretty similar level.
Exactly. And that scope for subjectivity, I suppose, is nearly where fesh fixing actually came from. Because
fesh fixing, I love the expression.
Apparently, the credit for that, I think, goes to Joe Duffy. I think he was the first one to roll it out, and obviously stuck in the Irish vernacular instantly after that. But it is because, as you say, if you're at the All-Irelands or you're at the Worlds, you're probably in the top 1% of dancers globally. And if you're on that podium, you know, in the most competitive categories, it's probably the teenage girls. The girls that's in first, second and third place, most of the time, there's probably not that much between them. And what seemed to happen with the germination of these allegations of cheating was that the teachers nearly thought they were doing like political lobbying for their dancers. They would come up to, like, say, the Munster Championships and be like, well, this girl placed really well in the Worlds last year and she's really skilled and this went wrong for her last year. So when they were texting the judges the night before a competition saying, I really think Siobhan deserves to be first, they thought that they were doing something altruistic. They thought, oh, if I feel like this system is rigged and other people are engaging in this, wouldn't I be like a very poor advocate for my dancers to not do it? And that, I think, this is just my view from writing the book, I think that's the moral grey area that a lot of people found shelter in when they were engaging in this. They didn't even recognise it as cheating at all. They thought that they were doing the best that they could in a system that was imperfect.
Yeah, but going beyond that, were there times when money changed hands, when sexual favours were asked for and given?
There was the difficulty I had explaining it to the news desk at the Indo, which is where I broke the story, was that there wasn't money involved. And they kept asking, like, why would people take this risk? And I suppose sometimes people cheat in sports, like in chess competitions or in fishing, for these big cash prizes. In Irish dancing, it's more unedifying in that it's just for glory and the glory of the adults who are the dance teachers and not the students. There was an element of the scandal that was seized on by the British tabloids, where people were talking about how when the judges and teachers were texting each other saying, can you arrange for so-and-so to be looked after tomorrow? There were two gay men who were kind of like exchanging sexual jokes with each other. But having learnt about them, having seen as much of the message threads as I could, I think that was a little blown out of proportion. I think it was two people kind of talking shy to each other. And there was a strange thing that happened where, because they were two men, there was like a weird kind of homophobic campaign against one of them later on. I go into it in more detail in the book. I just put it this way. You know, if people were having illicit affairs at Irish dancing competitions, they wouldn't be the first or last. And I don't think it's reserved to gay men.
There's one thing of having an affair, but it's different if it then influences the marking in competition, where one child gets marked up or another one gets marked down.
Yeah, and a lot of people seized on. There was a particular exchange in the text where one person said, a 100 is the highest score that a judge can give. I'll give you a 100 for, I'll let the listeners use their imaginations. But I went back and checked the tabulations and there was no 100 given. That was zoned in on, I think, because it made the whole story sound a little bit more salacious, but it kind of missed the point in that the point was you have this little network where a relatively small group of people know each other very well. They've nursed rivalries and alliances with each other over the decades. They take turns judging and teaching. So if you had a teacher you were friendly with and you were judging their kids, you would look after them on the understanding that when the role was reversed, when that other person was judging yours, they would return the favour. And all of this was just inherently contributing to this idea that Irish dancing is inherently unfair. And when I was researching the book, I actually went back to like the 19th and 20th century. And this was not new. People had been like getting into fisticuffs at feshes in the 19th century over who they thought the rightful winner is. So I'm not sure what it is about this sport, but people genuinely seem to have been fighting about Irish dancing for as long as they've been doing it.
But is there another element to this, that the competitions are largely between children and maybe you have their parents or guardians acting out their own desires and ambitions, putting an enormous amount of pressure on the children.
Yes, and I don't want to be gendered in my remarks, but the people that I was often most afraid of when I was covering the story were the dance moms, because they would be quite vocal if they felt that I got something wrong. I remember I went on primetime one night and used the word pageantry to describe the hair and the makeup. Never made that mistake ever again after the feedback I got from some of those ladies. But you're correct. I saw a very nasty side of Irish dancing. Unfortunately, I'm not saying it's representative of it, but parents who would spend their evenings sitting on social media abusing other 14-year-old girls online because they happen to be rivals with their daughters. Obviously, that pressure that tends to come. And unfortunately, I did see it sometimes in maybe the more American market where people are vicariously living out their dreams through their children. The guilt that comes with being a child and knowing that your family might have like remortgaged or sank the family savings into getting you through this incredibly, incredibly expensive sport. And the anguish as well, sometimes when I was talking to parents who were saying, there's so much about this sport that I really don't like and I'd love to get him or her out of it, like get their kids out of it.
So do they call it a sport?
Oh, absolutely, without question. Like, I think that it was, as weird as it sounds and as much abuse as I got, there was times when I felt really protective of Irish dancing because I feel like sometimes it's not taken as seriously as it should be because of the hair and the makeup and the tan and, yes, the kind of like Dolly Parton circus that tends to go with it and the glam and the weird characters and all and the fish fixing scandal, I guess, as well. But the athleticism, you can't deny it. It is definitely without question a sport, but it just has that complexity of being, I guess some people would say, like a cultural art form as well. And I suppose in Ireland, like we've kind of left it alone to its own devices to govern itself for over a century. In a way that I don't think we would ever tolerate that if the GAA or a similar organisation was kind of left to kind of be solely focused on competition rather than on protecting the culture of the sport as well.
After all the controversies of recent years, do you believe that the contests now are free and fair?
I'll put it to you this way. People can only go on their own experience. And I know a lot of people had a very, very positive experience in Irish dancing, but I wrote a dedication at the start of the book to my son, Adam, and told him that he's an amazing little boy who can do anything in the world, but probably not Irish dancing based on my experience over the last few years. I think that it's an incredible sport, but if it could be kept and maintained and made more about how incredible and beautiful this sport is and how historically important it is and less about winning the most trophies and the most medals, I would feel a little bit more comfortable letting my own children participate in it, I think.
Ellen Coyne, thank you so much. The book is Dirty Dancing.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.